I was a 21-year-old college student when I first heard the term anorexia nervosa. I scratched my head for a moment and then asked, what's that? Yes, eating disorders and disordered eating were present in our culture 40 years ago, but they were largely unknown and misunderstood. Today, the pressure to be thin and perfect is an ever-present part of our lives. Consequently, virtually all of our young middle school students are familiar with the names of these eating disorders. Many struggle with disordered eating themselves. As people who care for and love kids, what do we need to know about eating disorders and disordered eating? How can we recognize, prevent, and respond to the cultural pressures and the resulting health issues? Youth workers Susie Brahms and Nick Mance join me to ask questions and learn about the epidemic of eating disorders from counselor Julie Lowe on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, I'm a little tired this morning, Chris. It's been it was a long 3 days. Two days of which were travel.
You did some travel, right?
Yeah.
North Dakota, correct?
I did. I was in North Dakota one full day. Let's see, I started on Sunday. What time was that I was out? I mean, it was like 15 hours of travel by the time I got there. And then one full day on the way back as well.
Was it long, a good trip, though?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you saw the picture I sent you about who I saw in the airport.
Yeah. The guy who I'm thankful the Bills did not even have the chance to draft.
Yeah, I came around the corner in the Denver airport and on Sunday. I came around the corner and I was down at one end. All right, so now Denver airport, if you've been there, it's big. You know, it's big. You have to walk from one end to the other. It's long. And I came in at one of the least traveled places because I came on a smaller plane. And I came around the corner, and there was this guy standing. I was like, that guy looks familiar. And he had a Cleveland Browns bag, and on it was a name tag that was a flat, you know, like Cleveland Browns helmet, and it said Baker Mayfield. And it was Baker Mayfield. And so the funniest thing about it was nobody noticed him, but as I was standing there walking past, you know, as he was just standing there looking around about where he was going to go, this woman came up to him. And she had a Cleveland Browns helmet and a Sharpie marker.
And this is past the security.
This is like way in there. Like, you know, so I was telling, I sent it to you.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I sent it to Lisa, my wife. And she, you know how she responded? Just with a question mark. Like,
probably, who's that?
Yeah, who is it? And when I told her, you know, then it was another response with a question mark, which was great. But I sent it to Jason, and Jason said what I was thinking. He said, Who carries a Cleveland Browns helmet with them and a Sharpie marker in the Denver airport?
Yeah.
That it
full
was
size?
Just, yeah. Yeah.
And everything, yeah.
Yeah. But I was in North Dakota, Minot, North Dakota, which is just beneath the Canadian border. They have a university there, Minot State, and their slogan is Why Not Minot? And I got to go out there to speak at the fundraising banquet for Our Redeemer's Christian School, which is a great, man, what wonderful, beautiful people. I sat next to a couple from Antler, North Dakota.
That's a great name.
Yeah, just south of Moose Jaw in Saskatchewan. So it was a lot of fun. It was a great time. Do you know who everybody talked about out there?
I have a guess.
The name that came up. Yeah,
should we have one of our guests here try?
Yeah, yeah. So I have joining us today, because Jason's not here, and we brought in Nick Mance, who's
Nick's, right here.
Yep, and you're a youth pastor at Hershey Free Church.
Yep, been there for about a year now.
So. Nick's here because a little later we're going to talk with Julie Lowe about disordered eating and eating disorders. We've had Julie on before. She's a counselor. And I thought, man, you know, since Jason's not here, let's bring in a couple of youth workers. So Nick's one, and the other is Susie Brahms, who's joining us. She's not in the room with us, but she's joining us via Skype. Susie, where are you
Hi.
At? Where are you sitting right now?
I'm sitting at my husband's desk. At church, free of kids, right here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
All right, Pittsburgh. All right. So this is why we're going to start talking about football right now, briefly. We've been talking about Baker Mayfield. Cleveland Browns, is that your arch rival?
Oh, we have many. Cleveland.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I mean,
because nobody likes the Steelers, right? Except if you're from Pittsburgh.
Everybody likes the Steelers.
Okay, oh, that's right. That's in your world out there in Pittsburgh. This is, you got to understand, we're in the eastern side of the state. They're in the western side. And like when I travel, people will say to me, oh, you're a Steelers fan. And I'll just look at them.
Do you die a little bit inside when they tell
I
you
do.
That?
I do.
You do?
I do. I have to go to the restroom and, you know.
Clean up a
yeah,
little bit.
Yeah, just a sweat. I just the whole thing. But, yeah, so they don't – people, if they're not from Pennsylvania, I don't think they understand the rivalry. And they're not even in the same – you know, one's in the AFC, one's in the NFC, but still – And I was nervous this year because everybody kept saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if it's an all-Pennsylvania Super Bowl? I said, no.
The state would burn.
I have too many friends. You know, well, the state would burn no matter what if the Eagles are in it. But that's just the way it happened. But so yeah, Susie's a Steelers fan. But do you know?
So my guess is Nick probably has a good guess as to who everybody in North Dakota was talking about.
Well, oh, my word.
Obviously, it was Walt Mueller.
No. It wasn't me. It was
Well, of course it was Carson Wentz.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I do have to just backpedal a little bit. I'm surprised that you found the one Cleveland Browns fan in the entire U.S. in that airport.
Yes,
that was
amazing. Right. Yeah.
But, of course, why? I mean, North Dakota State is up there, Bison Pride and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Where Wentz is from, so, of course.
Well, here's what's interesting. So I'm at the banquet, and I started, you know, I said, hey, I'm from Philadelphia, and everybody starts talking about Carson Wentz. I'd walk out in the hallway. And somebody would walk up to me and go, they'd just say two words, Carson Wentz, you know, and they'd smile. And I'd say, oh, yeah, he's pretty awesome. I'm glad you sent him our way. And then they'd talk about, you know, my mom, her best friend is best friends with Carson Wentz's mom. So everybody who came to me had a connection with Carson Wentz. And when I'd, you know, scratch my head about it, I asked one, so I said, is this true? Everybody somehow is connected, and somebody looked at me funny and said, do you know what our population is here? I mean, it is. It's true. Everybody is somehow related to him or knows him, and they love him.
So did you get his cell phone number from these people?
No, I didn't.
Well,
but, I didn't.
But the day before you flew out, you had your own Carson Wentz connection.
Two nights before, and I want to talk about this because this was phenomenal. I don't know if youth workers have seen this. But there was circulating around the internet was this invitation into this live stream on, you know, and we're recording this just a few days after it'll be, this podcast will be released. So it's been a couple weeks ago once this is released. But Paul Tripp, who we're big fans of, right? And he got his
Absolutely.
Start at CCEF, Christian Counseling Education Foundation, where Julie Lowe's from, who we're going to talk to today. Paul writes a lot of books. Paul does a lot of conferences. We just love Paul Tripp. Paul put together an event called the Faith Playbook. Did you watch it, Nick, or did you?
I did not get the opportunity to watch it, but, I mean, just hearing about it, looking back on it, it was phenomenally done.
Well, here's the good news. You still can. And even, Susie, you and your Pittsburgh Steelers fans would benefit from this. You can go to Faith Playbook or just Google the Faith Playbook, and they are selling streaming licenses for this. And people say, oh, it's a money-making thing. No, a lot of the money is actually going to go to charitable organizations and foundations that are part of the players. But what Paul did was he brought in seven of the Eagles football players. My son-in-law, Rick, he and I went down to Philly. There were 2,000 men. It was a men's event. And we sat in the auditorium there at Calvary Chapel. A shout-out to Gil Trusty, who made it possible for us to be down there, our good friend Gil, at Calvary Chapel in Philadelphia, and Paul interviewed these seven players in pairs, on their own. It was just brilliantly done, and in the end, he brought them all out. But it was really about talking about faith and life and the maturity of these guys, and I blogged about this because I said, you know, a lot of what you see in faith and sports is, you know, score a touchdown, point to heaven, kneel down, pray, and then just play however you want to play. For these guys, and we knew this all year, it was really, their faith is deep and serious. And just so you know, if you watch it, you'll hear Paul tell the story of how this came to be. This was not as a result of the Eagles winning the Super Bowl. This was planned way before the season started. And the way that Paul made to connect with these guys was he was eating in a restaurant in Philly, and two of the players came in. He saw them over there, and before their meal, they bowed their heads and prayed, and he was just intrigued by this and went over and chatted with them and it winds up he's become somewhat of a spiritual mentor to these guys, and their inquisitiveness about spiritual growth is really, really amazing. So youth workers, it's worth watching. It's worth streaming, especially in front of your athletes. You can do it on demand. I get nothing out of, you know, advertising this, in case you're wondering that, other than the great joy of knowing you can point your...
Here, hang on. Let me. Yeah, I got a dollar. A I can give you a dollar.
Is that all you have?
There you go. I'll give
you
a dollar.
Carry... How much money's in that wallet?
Like $2. No, three. I got three.
Yeah, $3. You carry more than I carry. And this
is
part.
I don't know why I have it.
Well, for me, I stopped carrying money when I had kids. I don't know if you do. You and Bobby do that, Susie. But of course, we take all your money at CPYU when you come to the.
We have none.
You have no money left. But because your kids are always asking, "Hey, Dad, can I have a buck?" You know, especially when you're at a game or something. Can I go to the concession? I don't have any money, and I want to tell the truth on that. So I wouldn't carry it. But it's just worth saying. This is worth seeing. So it's a good thing.
Well, I do remember you posting several articles around Super Bowl about your players, your Eagles, and just their faith, the depth of it. And I really appreciate reading those, even as a Steelers fan.
Yeah.
I give them credit that it was a pretty amazing season for them.
Hey, you know, and here's the great thing is, I know on every team there are players like this. It sometimes gets lost in all the other stuff that goes on with professional sports and football. But, you know, to see guys that – you know, the way that I talk about it is that these are guys who are Christians who happen to play football. And I like, you know, that integration of faith into all of life, which is something we need to talk about in youth ministry all the time. So, yeah. So, Nick, just so you know about Nick, Nick's local here to us. It's at CPYU. We're in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania. He's in the next town over, Hershey. Hey, when you pulled in this morning, did you notice that E-Town smelled a little different than Hershey?
It did. It smelled like chocolate out here a little bit more than it did in
Hershey. You smelled that?
I smelled that.
Because when I stepped out of the office this morning, I didn't smell the chocolate. I smelled the other smell.
Well, I was just shocked that, you know, I can work there every day and I don't smell anything. It's like I come to visit you and it's like, what is going on? It's like, I didn't know if you were trying to like be like, hey, we're better or what was going on.
So you smelled, because we have an M&M Mars factory in town. If the wind's blowing right, you smell that. But this morning, when you and I got here, Chris, I don't know if you noticed a smell, but we're in that season right now where the farmers are spreading the liquid manure.
And chocolate.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Oh, that must have been. You guys have been real hungry coming in.
I'm just going to tell you the chocolate was losing this morning when I came in. It was the other smell that was winning. It was bad.
It's kind of one of those funny things where, you know, to some extent, the farm smells can be okay by themselves.
See, this is what I was talking about before, where when I agree with him, I have to start to worry. Because if I agreed with him on this would worry me.
But the chocolate smell by itself is okay. The farm smells, there's some farm smells that are over the top, but some smart farm smells by themselves can be tolerable and have their own.
Now you're saying tolerable. A few seconds ago, you were saying you wanted to bottle it up
or anything like that.
Okay.
You don't have that air freshener at home, you know, a la manure, like in your house.
But when you mix the two, when you get the mixture of the two, there is something weird that happens, and it is bad.
You know, I will say this.
It ruins both smells for you. It ruins them. Ruin.
Yeah. Yep. I will say, though, like I can deal with like the manure smell, where Lisa and I lived when we first got married in Iowa, there was a Purina processing plant for dog food. There is nothing like the smell of fresh cooked dog food when you get up in the morning to make you just want to like die a little bit.
It's
more.
Bad.
It's bad. Like if you think back to like Gravy Train, you remember that?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, picture like that smell just like right here for the entire day. It was dismal.
Did you get used to it?
No, there's no way you can get used to that.
Yeah, because see, I think I've gotten used to some of the farm smells around here. When we first moved here, it was brutal. But
I mean, I could tell when they're making bacon strips. I mean, if that helps at all. But you definitely need to get used to it.
Susie, do you have any interesting smells in Pittsburgh?
We have the smell of victory mostly here.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to say anything about the smell of victory 2 days after the Penguins bowed out. Of the Stanley Cup.
That was heartbreaking.
Yeah, that was not the smell of victory. But, you know, talking about dog food, okay, I'm just going to ask this question. I'm going to ask this question, and I'm going to poll all three of you. I want you to be – will you promise you'll be honest with me?
Sure.
Okay, so when I was in elementary school, I went to the bus stop one morning, and one of my buddies brought one of those boxes. Have you seen those boxes of Milk Bone dog biscuits, and it's like seven different shapes, seven different colors, seven different flavors. And we proceeded. I mean, because they, you know, for an elementary school kid, I'll just be honest, they looked a little appetizing. You know, you saw cheese, sausage, beef. I mean, I don't know what the other flavors were. And we actually did taste tests of all seven. I found that they all tasted the same, bad. Have any of you ever eaten? We've got youth workers here. I got to ask this question. Have any of you ever tried a dog biscuit?
No.
I feel like I have, actually.
Why do you make it so complex? It's either a yes or no question.
You know, I think I have. I just can't remember exactly. Like, it feels like something I would have tried. So,
well, knowing you, yeah. What haven't you eaten? But, you know, you should know.
Cilantro, it would have left that's what I have
yeah, okay.
Eaten.
It would have left an impression, either positive or negative. Nick?
I'm ashamed to admit this, but I referenced Gravy Train earlier, and actually when I was a kid, we had a dog, we had the Gravy Train, and I actually ate the Gravy Train. My parents caught me one time, like a dog, like face first in the bowl, eating the Gravy Train because I thought it was human food.
How old were you?
I was like last week. No, it was I was maybe like 3 or 4, I would guess. But I mean,
and you remember this?
Sadly.
Okay, yeah. So let me ask this question. You took a bite.
I did.
Did you take a second bite?
From what I remember, I just kept going until my parents pulled me off of it.
That's sick.
You're judging me a lot right now.
You're going to answer this honestly, right?
Truthful,
and then
right?
I'm
glad. Going next CPYU auction.
Actually, we had not planned this conversation at all, right? This was not an avenue we were going to go down.
No,
this is a good
this
segue.
This is my own fault. I offered this up.
Because now we're going to talk to a counselor after the break about disordered eating.
Yeah.
I'm the example.
Yeah, me too. I tried all those doggone dog biscuits. So,
although in my defense, I will say this, and I'm not going to say who I've done it to, but I've probably made more people eat dog biscuits than I have consumed myself, just in my line of working with youth.
Oh yeah, that's part of it. You know,
I won't say where.
What will you
or how,
eat? What
yeah,
will
but,
you eat? Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I'd agree. I've never tried dog biscuits, but the disgusting things we've made students eat over the years. Mm-hmm. Dog biscuits look good.
Yep.
Okay, so three of us have tried dog biscuits. Susie, you haven't. I'm just curious. When we're done recording here today, is there a possibility you might try one?
No.
Okay.
Right. I still won't try one. I'm sorry.
You know what I'd do if I were you? I'd tell Bobby about this conversation, because I'll bet you he would go do it.
Oh, he would.
Yeah. He would go. Do you guys have a dog?
We do.
Okay, yeah. So he'll go right out to the cabinet. Yeah, yeah. Keep an eye on him today.
I will. You'll have to give him a little taunting to do it. But
yeah, okay. Yeah, well, like I said, he's easy. He's a pushover. We can get him to do that. So let's segue. I'm glad you guys are here to join Chris and I today. But we're going to talk to Julie Lowe, who's a counselor, after the break about disordered eating and eating disorders. And before we go to the break, let me just read. I've got a stack of papers here with a variety of eating disorder statistics, and we'll include some links to some sites that have these. And I'm just going to go through this in no special order. Let me just read a few here. Why is it important to talk about? Onset of anorexia nervosa is most commonly around the same time as puberty. And by the way, that term, I've talked about this before on the podcast, that term anorexia nervosa, I never heard till I was 21 years old. Senior in college, and somebody who was a friend of mine was struggling with it, and I had to ask the question, what is that? And I think all of my peers did. It wasn't that we were ignorant. We didn't know, because it wasn't an issue that was, I'm sure it was happening, but we didn't understand it, and it certainly wasn't as widespread as it is now. Let me rifle through here, see if I can find a couple more. According to the DSM, disordered eating is defined as a wide range of irregular eating behaviors that do not warrant a diagnosis of a specific eating disorder. Many individuals with disordered eating symptoms are diagnosed with eating disorder not otherwise specified, known by the acronym EDNOS, EDNOS. Disordered eating is a descriptive phase, not a diagnosis. And I think Julie will talk about this, that that's much more widespread than the actual diagnosis of an eating disorder. The National Institute of Mental Health reports that 2.7% of teens ages 13 to 18 years old struggle with an eating disorder, almost 3%. 50% of teenage girls 30% of teenage boys use unhealthy weight control behaviors such as skipping meals, fasting, smoking cigarettes, vomiting, and taking laxatives to control their weight. 25% of college-aged women engage in binging and purging as a method of managing their weight. Over 50% of teenage girls, 33% of teenage boys are using restrictive measures to lose weight at any given time. 46% of 9 to 11-year-olds, that's before they hit our middle school ministries, right, are sometimes or very often on diets. There's several more statistics we could read, but there was one that I found earlier that, and you know I'm going to rifle through this and try to find it. I've got, this is like when you're speaking, you know, and you have all kinds of notes, and somebody turns the fan on, and everything just kind of goes, okay, here it is. This will be the last one. Anorexia is the third most common chronic disease among young people after asthma and type 1 diabetes. Oh. Yeah. So, and it's no respecter of persons. It's evening out girls and boys, and we're going to talk about this when we come back. So stick with us for a conversation about eating disorders and disordered eating with Counselor Julie Lowe. Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators. Well, Julie Lowe is a counselor at the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation. She has an MA in counseling from Biblical Theological Seminary. She's got years and years of counseling experience and extensive experience with women's issues, sexual abuse, body image issues, parenting, all sorts of things. We've had Julie on the podcast before, and we're excited to have her here today to talk about a topic that I wish we didn't need to talk about, but we do. And that's disordered eating and eating disorders, which I believe we all know, if we're raising kids and working with kids, are at epidemic proportions in our culture. So, Julie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad this worked out. We've tried to have Julie on several times since the last time we had her on the podcast, and every single time it seemed like we had some kind of crazy technical issue, and it all worked out. It's seamless this time, so... We're happy you're here. Julie, talk a little bit about the difference between eating disorders and disordered eating.
Probably one of the things that stands out most about the difference might be how it manifests itself. So there are many, many young people and adults alike who would not say they had an eating disorder, but they clearly would have disordered eating. So what do I mean by that? We tend to think of eating disorders as something clinical, like anorexia, bulimia, obsessive eating, something that is obvious, clear-cut, that's being treated or in counseling for. But I think we are raising a generation of young people with very disordered patterns of eating and mentalities about eating that from the outside do not look maybe necessarily concerning, but are very concerning in nature by what motivates them and, the lack of healthiness of it, but also the disordered mentality behind the eating.
How extensive, you know, in your counseling, you've been counseling for years. Statistically, do you know how extensive these issues are, and do you see a rise? I mean, it would seem to me you've seen an increased, I would assume you've had an increased caseload with this.
Yeah, for sure. And I think probably what's more concerning is that
less and less people are seeing it as concerning. So it's almost more acceptable to be disordered in your thinking, or at least probably even a broader way of saying it is in body image issues. So eating disorders is wrapped up in body image issues, but I think there is a growing acceptance of an unhealthy way, a disordered way about thinking about body image and eating.
Let me. I'm going to throw a question. We've got a couple of folks with us. Nick Mance is here as a youth pastor in Hershey, and then Susie Broms, who has served as a youth pastor out in the Pittsburgh area. And I'm just curious with the two of you, you know, with what Julie's talking about here. In your experience, are you seeing this, and have you seen it more with your students? And then talk about girls and boys. And now I want to go back to Julie and ask about that as well.
Susie, do you want to weigh in first?
Sure. I think the hard part is remembering that girls and boys both suffer from this. And I think the hard part is seeing the signs of it, recognizing the signs of it, because you can go about your ministry and your life and not really recognize what's happening with these students, these young people, and how it is changing them. So I think that's the hardest part for me.
And we'll come back. I want to talk about, ask Julie about signs and things to look for with that. What about you, Nick? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing it across the board with both with guys and girls. I mean, as somebody like in high school, I was a wrestler. And so cutting weight was always something that we were told to do and into extreme proportions sometimes. And I see male students struggling with that now when it comes to sports. It's like they have to maintain, like, you know, a certain body image for that. And it radically alters who they are. And it's not immune to one gender over the other. It's across the board for them. And it's something that I think with media, traumatic events, all these different things that contribute to it, you just see this just continue to be on the rise.
Mm. Julie, let me ask you this. In your experience, are there certain patterns in a young person's life that youth workers and parents can look for? Like Nick said, you know, athletes. And I've read a little bit on that disordered eating disorders are really prevalent among athletes. And I think I saw something where like 25% of female college athletes have struggled with these things at some point. Are there certain things we should look for? We say, yeah, this group of people is more susceptible to this than to another group. Are there certain factors involved that we should be aware of?
Good question. There's probably lots of ways we can answer that. Let me actually start with guys, because you're right, particularly wrestlers. You see weightlifters will struggle with that, and that tends to be a body image issue. There's actually a phrase that was coined by somebody called bigorexia, mm-hmm. where anorexia is about, you know, starving yourself. Bigorexia is about the use of steroids and becoming as big as possible. So you see particularly in the weightlifting movement, huge body image issues, eating disorder, disordered eating. Wrestlers, for sure. My boys have just gotten into wrestling over the last couple of years, and so my eyes have been open to something that I probably don't witness a lot in counseling, because I tend to work with a lot of young women. So I just want to validate those places are places to watch for how young men particularly are thinking about the issue. And I think steroids comes in a multiple levels of athletic sports as well. That said, with young women, it used to be athletics, but I think it's just prevalent across the board. So you have, with the growing use of media, you have a biologically unattainable ideal being put out there on a regular basis. So even with magazine covers, used to be girls going through teen magazines, things like that. Now you can't open an iPod, iPhone, anything without having this imagery out there. And what we're seeing by experts in the field is a lot of models that are held out there as an ideal are computer generated. They're not even real anymore. They're taking the eyes of one person and the mouth of another. So now you're being held to an ideal that does not even truly exist. So you have the media that promotes a biologically unattainable ideal. You now have a diet industry that promises to deliver that. You have food that is a God-given creational thing for both sustenance and fellowship, by the way. But that becomes a tempting taboo, and we use language like that, like it's evil and taboo and tempting. And now you add plastic surgery that ups the stakes of perfection. And more young people are turning to that as well, as it's feasible. So you just see this this culture that is actually allowing this to continue and producing avenues, new avenues to be addicted to it.
So one of the things that we've tracked with over the years here at CPYU is marketing. And we've looked at the power of marketing, and you've mentioned that with the ads, with the magazine covers. Magazine covers are ads, in effect. And we always say the greatest power of marketing today is not so much to sell product, but to sell a worldview, a way of looking at life, developing beliefs that then influence behaviors, which I think is yielding what we're talking about here today with disordered eating and eating disorders. And one of the latest statistics that I've seen says that teenagers see, on average in a day, between 4,000 and 10,000 marketing messages. And most of those use human beings to sell product, and human beings with a certain body image and that kind of thing. And so you've mentioned marketing, and I really think that youth workers need to, and parents need to push back by helping temper the messages of marketing, get young people to think critically and Christianly about marketing. But beyond that, I wrote down two other things here, and there's more, but I'd like you, Julie, to comment on these. What about, first, the role of social media in this? What have you seen with that? I mean, would you see that as something that's pushing this?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. How could it not? Because we're, and you guys would be familiar with the research where social media kind of feeds narcissism, or just a self-promotion. We're a people fascinated with ourselves, obsessed with ourselves on social media, and always trying to recreate yourself and put your best foot forward. So the pressure is high and unrealistic. And the way young people do that, they're always trying to present themselves and to take 1,000 selfies until they get just the right one. So it feeds into this struggle, very much so.
Let me ask Nick and Susie about that. Have you, in your ministry with kids, have you talked about that? Have you talked about social media? Have you pushed back on that? That would be a proactive way, but have you also reacted in a sense where you've tracked with your students and watched how they curate themselves and present themselves and then responded that way? Is it anything that's been helpful there that we could pass on to others? If you've done nothing, I put you on the spot here, but go ahead, whatever you've done.
Just throw us under the bus.
Yeah, if you've done nothing, you better start, right? Yeah.
Well, I think one place that we had a lot of success in starting was helping our students take an honest look at themselves and why they use social media and how they use it. Starting with, when you post an image, what's your goal? What's your goal with your picture? Is it for likes? Is it because you're sharing a happy moment in your life? And one thing we found is that students will remove pictures if they do not get enough likes. If it's not hitting, on Instagram, the amount of likes they want, then they'll delete it. It's gone. And so helping them kind of rethink why they're doing it. But also, I think it's important to follow your students on all social media. And then to kind of have that conversation with them in private if it's at an unhealthy point, if their images are inappropriate, if who they're presenting isn't really who they are.
Yeah, I would affirm all of that. I mean, we have our own social media for the church I work at, for student ministries, on multiple platforms. We've gotten to the root of the issue with students and just talking identity throughout the year and saying, hey, like, what type of identity are you having? We always tie it back with social media because, how many of them are on, like, social media while I'm talking to them and giving a message or whatever.
Right.
But just saying, hey, are you representing yourself? Are you representing a false image? And then getting to the heart of that and saying, like, what are you hoping to get from this? I know, Walt, you've talked about Finsta and Rinsta before, yeah. And like having the fake profile versus the real profile. And I mean, it's like, I feel like every day I'm finding students who have like 4 or 5 fake profiles that they're trying to have this false persona. And For us, it's like getting to the heart of the issue and saying, okay, like, do you know that your identity is rooted in Christ? It's not rooted in your identity of likes or a following or the perception of this corrupt body image that the culture is just presenting to us. It's rooted in who Christ made you to be.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I feel like that's a daily battle we walk through with our students of just encouraging and pushing them into that.
Yeah. Julie, I want to ask you about identity, because I know at CCEF, you folks, as biblical counselors, you really address this, and you address it in powerful ways that I think are quite compelling. When you are counseling someone who's struggling with an eating disorder, disordered eating, how do you address the issue of identity, and what would be helpful for a parent and a youth worker, you know, who's not a counselor, but who really is on the front lines there, maybe in a preventive way, but also in a redemptive, responsive way? How do we talk about identity?
Yeah, I love what you guys are saying, because you're hitting right on that. Their identity issues at the heart of it, and they're image bearers. I mean, we were created as image bearers. And so isn't it ironic? Here's imagery all day long being thrown at us. And what are we trying to image is the question. And so it's a replacing of a value system. How do I dictate my own worth and value? And ultimately, do I value the God of thinness or the God of perfection or the God of beauty? What is it that eventually enslaves me? So a metaphor I like to use a lot in counseling is that of mirrors, that somebody who struggles with body image or eating disorders, and again, there's tons of motivation behind that. Everybody's not the same. But what happens, it's like you're trapped in a room full of mirrors where everything you do is a reflection of you. All you're seeing is yourself. And those mirrors isolate us. Not only do they isolate us, they're more like carnival mirrors. They're not an accurate picture. They're very distorted. So it's like looking in a carnival mirror where you will never see yourself quite accurately because you're using the wrong thing to judge yourself to begin with. But it is like living in a room full of mirrors, and everywhere you go, there's a mirror reflecting back at you. And the danger of that is it really isolates you. It means that you can only see others through the lens in which they see you. It enslaves you and I to an image of what others think of my image, or enslaves us to what we fear people think or we hope people think about us. It prevents you and I from being known and truly knowing others. And it destroys relationships. It's a separation, and the stakes get higher of being vulnerable and authentic and real because I've got to maintain this image. So all those things just breed kind of a self-obsession in the most isolating of ways. And a lot of times I talk about, how do you break those mirrors? How do you break them down so that real relationship, real knowing and intimacy can be known? And part of that is embracing that I can be weak and broken. Not only can I be, but there's what God calls us to be. 2 Corinthians says, we're treasures in jars of clay, to show this all-surpassing power is of God, not of us, which means that I've got to be willing to be broken and have cracks and holes in my life so that the power of God can shine all the more brightly within me. And that will never happen if I'm too busy patching up those cracks and holes and trying to demonstrate perfection. What I want then is people to see me, not the power within me.
That is good. Let me ask you about one more factor that I want you to comment on, because as youth workers, we get to work with parents, and I think as well for parents who are listening, this would be helpful. But you talked a little bit about marketing. We've talked about social media and the peer culture. What about family? What role does family play in this, specifically in a negative causal way?
Modeling. You do see, and I do see, that when I'm meeting with young people in counseling, it's not always true, but there is a connection to what the parents have modeled as healthy or unhealthy eating, disordered. It's not usually just the eating. It's usually disordered lifestyle of exercise. So there's an obsession with maybe sports and exercise, nutrition, thinness. So even good motivations can run amok, right? Because the issue is not the behavior itself, but the degree to which we allow those things to dictate our worth. So it's this subtle unspoken message sometimes that this is a high value in this home. And if you want to fit in or you want to be acceptable or okay, you will have this high value as well. So we take very good things like exercise and we turn them into something that's disordered.
Yeah.
In pattern.
Yeah, and I know at CCEF you guys talk a lot about the idols in our lives and fear of man, and I think this plays into this in some big ways. And what I hear you saying is it's not just, like a lot of times parents would say, well, I'm not going to contribute to this because I keep my mouth shut. I don't say, hey, you're looking heavy, or, you know, don't eat that, or, you know, boy, you better pull back. You know, so the stated things you're talking about, systemic things that maybe are unstated, not so much in words, but more in actions and just a family culture that creates this kind of thing. Before we break, one more question, because it does relate to social media, and I see this a lot with parents who are living vicariously through the achievements of their children, and they do it on social media, and a lot of it is based not just on, you know, academic accomplishments or athletic accomplishments, but just on appearance, you know, putting out the picture of the perfect family. Are you seeing this playing into it more and more?
Yeah, definitely. And I'll speak even as a parent of six. I always feel that tension of wanting to celebrate my kids' achievements and be proud of them. But also, because I see this so much, I'll find myself actually reserving posting things sometimes, because one is I don't want to portray the perfect ideal family. And another, because it could create this standard for my children that this is where I find pleasure in them or delight in them, and that they have to maintain it. So I don't think most parents attempt to do that. I just think it's such an acceptable practice. And those are some of the unknown repercussions of it that parents maybe aren't thinking about.
Yeah, good, good. All right, well, we need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Julie, and I want to get into some of the practical responses that are preventive, and we're going to give Nick and Susie a chance to ask some questions on behalf of youth workers. We're talking to Julie Lowe, a counselor, and we're talking about eating disorders and disordered eating among teens. Stick with us. Here at the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, we want to help you stay up to date on today's youth culture. One of the tools we've developed to keep you current is our weekly Youth Culture e-update. Delivered to you by email, our Youth Culture e-update comes to you in a format that allows you to easily scroll through and quickly choose those stories and resources that will be most helpful to you in your particular setting. To sign up for this free resource, go to our website at cpyu.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and enter your email address in the tab marked e-update sign up. It's that simple. Well, welcome back to Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller, and I'm joined here today in the absence of Jason Sochenik with Susie Brahms, who's joining us from Pittsburgh, a youth worker out there. Nick Mance is here with us in the studio. He's from Hershey Free Church, doing youth ministry there, and we're having a conversation with Julie Lowe, a counselor, about eating disorders, disordered eating, identity. We know that that's certainly, you know, right at the root of this whole thing, and we've talked about that before the break, but we're talking about ways to identify, ways to respond to kids who in our group are part of this large epidemic now, this growing epidemic of disordered eating and eating disorders. And by the way, we're going to include on the website, if you are listening, streaming through, you know, one of the podcast platforms, come back to cpyu.org, go to the Youth Culture Matters page for this particular episode. And as you scroll down, you'll see a list of resources that you can click on, any of the books that we mention, other resources throughout the rest of the podcast. We'll include links to those, so you'll be able to look for some things on there that will help with, you know, a list of signs and symptoms and things. But I want to go back to our conversation with Julie. And in your counseling, Julie, you've obviously counseled lots of older people and younger people who have struggled with body image issues and disordered eating at a variety of levels. When you see a person take steps to overcome this, obviously God is at work in their lives. But what sorts of, you know, what sorts of variables are there as well that allow them to overcome this difficulty? You've talked about the mirror. How do we get them to stop looking in those mirrors and see themselves in light of God's word and who he's made them to be?
Supportive community is probably number one in my mind. And with that goes what they're saying in that supportive community. But having a community surrounding you, giving you a very different message of self-acceptance, of it's okay to be broken, weak, imperfect. So family would be foremost, but for those who are youth workers, creating that culture in a youth group is phenomenal in sending the message, you can have messy hair, you don't have to post and have 1,000 likes on your post, you don't have to be perfect. When there's a community around somebody affirming that, it breaks down the walls. I mean, there can be genuine vulnerability and intimacy, which is key in meaningful relationships. I really believe we're called to grow in community that way, but particularly when it comes to disordered eating and body image issues, for them to hear a very different message, and that creates a level of acceptance and embracing of brokenness and weakness that's just utterly liberating.
Mm. I love that, supportive community. Have Susie and Nick, have you seen that work in your own setting? Have you, you know, what have you done to facilitate that, to break through the cultural standards that tend to control in many ways our youth group experiences? How do we break out of that and create this countercultural community?
Yeah, I know in my sphere of influence, like typically, like first of all, like we address culture as it comes. Like we're not ashamed of it. It's like we're unabashedly gonna step into what culture is dictating and saying. But we've told our students from day one, it's like, you know, church, youth group is not a place where you have to come and drop your baggage at the door and pretend that you have this perfect facade. And it's like, you can come here and be real. Like Christ doesn't call the perfect. He doesn't call the put together. He doesn't call like the people with all of the makeup on. He calls the broken and the people who need him. It's like, so why should we come any different? It's like, so if you're walking through difficulty, this is the place you should be able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. So even when you say talking about culture, you know, one of the little games we've talked about playing here when it comes to marketing is spot the lie. So, you know, throwing the messages up the kids are seeing 24/7, whether it be in print or video or online, and get them to see it through new eyes and say, okay, let's rather than let this speak to us and lie to us and shape how we view ourselves, mm-hmm. let's work together and spot the lies and call the lies out, which becomes a second nature skill then. So that's good. I like that. You know, getting them to process. I like what you said right there. I like all you said there, Nick, but what you said there at the beginning is really important. Susie, what about you?
Well, I think an important thing for me has been asking my students why that's important to them, why that picture is important, why this trending culture is important to them, and to start that conversation, to pick apart what's at the root of their infatuation for that or why they make that so important. And I think another thing is, and this is who we are in ministry, you know, I try to be really open about my flaws in life as I'm talking, as I'm leading. And while it's humorous for my students to hear, I think it helps them look at an adult who's following Christ, who doesn't have it perfect, who just comes as they are. And I think that sometimes we forget that as adults when we're working with students, that we don't have to have it together, that we can be vulnerable in appropriate ways and just real. And I think that's the best thing that we can start to do for our students to help them be more real about who they are too.
Yeah, so that builds that culture. I like that. And I would add to that, I think one of the really helpful things for me has been as I've gotten older and more secure in who I am, which some would interpret as just kind of giving up. Right? You get to a certain age where you just sort of give up. You're like, this is hopeless. There's nothing I can do with this anymore. But self-deprecating humor. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's disarming, I think, that people, they really appreciate that, you know. So if we can, you know, not work so much to keep ourselves up in this image, like Susie said, but this just be ourselves and be vulnerable, it's really, really helpful. What kills me, though, it's funny, Julie, when you were talking about the mirrors, with my travel, I'm really conscious of this. You know, you're in hotel room after hotel room. And I watched a news report once on skinny mirrors that they put in hotel rooms. those big full-length mirrors, and they actually, I find myself, they report, like, if you stand in front of those mirrors, you walk in front of it, you're going, man, yeah, I lost 40 pounds since I landed yesterday. They say down, like, on the bottom, you can look, and there's actually an insignia that says, you know, this is a mirror that doesn't really tell the truth, or what, skinny mirror, whatever. I've never seen that, but, it, you know, they put those in there to try to make you feel better about yourself, and maybe that's a way to market a hotel.
I'm going to find one of those to put in my office.
Yeah, you need a skinny mirror, so that was funny. Julie, I want to come back to you because you talked about building supportive community. Are there any other variables that you think would be really helpful?
Yeah, well, from a counseling standpoint, there are some really good books, and I'll have to take a minute to think about, but there's good literature out there now talking about eating disorders and disordered thinking. So it's the thought pattern behind it, what you accept. You know, really good stuff that's secular out there just doesn't go deep enough to underlie where is identity really found. And that's where we have answers the world doesn't have, that deep, meaningful identity is rooted in relationship with the Lord, and that actually we live in a kingdom upside down where God uses weakness and brokenness, not beauty and success. And so the Bible acknowledges great and small exist in every exchange of life. Yet we take a God-ordained difference and we use it as a tool to begin to measure ourselves against each other. And so part of what the church can do really well, families and parents can do really well, is to start to paint a very different picture of how we are called to live that both liberates and is equally as appealing. We need to do a better job of wooing kids to a better option. So we can speak of the dangers and the evils of success and advertising and beauty and materialism. However, we do a very poor job of demonstrating something more glorious on the other end to woo them to. And that is both our responsibility and should be our conviction, that as adults, we do a far better job making Christ look glorious and worth pursuing.
So what I hear you saying is beyond the cultural narrative that's speaking 24/7 to all of us, young to old, the full age spectrum, beyond just pointing out the lies there, let's talk about the biblical narrative, the biblical story. Let's do a better job at Christian nurture, at preaching the gospel to ourselves and preaching the gospel to our children. And that is really, really important. I love that. I think that's something. I mean, you would think that that's just a given in ministry, but I think a lot of times it's not. We just don't do that well. And so that's important, not just for youth workers, but for parents as well. I love Scotty Smith, who we've had on the podcast, always talks about preaching the gospel to yourself. Hmm. And that's been very helpful for me as an individual to do that at so many levels. So that's good. I just want to say, as you were talking about books there, too, and I don't know if you're familiar with this one, Julie, but Kristen Hatton's book, we had her on, Chris. Can you remember what the title?
FaceTime,
which is really addresses this from the standpoint of a mother who's a pastor's wife who had a daughter who has dealt with disordered eating. It's one of the best books written concisely with a great theology of identity. And Kristen did a great job, and that was a good podcast. She was a good guest when we had her on here. The other book I thought of when you were talking about this, Julie, and I'd love to hear you comment on this, is Ed Welch's book, When People Are Big and God Is Small. And didn't he write a version of that for teenagers as well?
What do you think about me and why do I care?
Yeah. Would you recommend those books, you know, Fear of Man and...
Absolutely. I use them in counseling all the time with people because they're just really street level for people to read. People can connect with them. They're really good. And piggybacking off of that is we need to give kids freedom that there's creative liberty to live out who they are. So sometimes I think we come across as anti-beauty or anti-anything that's creative liberty and self-expression. And I think the beauty of the gospel is it actually liberates us to be creative, to express ourselves. The difference is all true beauty points back to the creator of that which is beautiful. It doesn't point to ourselves. But you have people that live a very stoic life. They're anti-beauty. And I think sometimes that's the message we give in response to kids as well, instead of freeing them to say, You can be a jock, you can be preppy, you can be this. Just know where your true value is found. But once you've rooted yourself in that, there is creative expression and liberty in life. And God's creation is such an example of that. I mean, you can't watch some of those movies on life and planet Earth and not point back to saying, wow, what a creative God we have. He doesn't limit us. He actually liberates us.
Mm-hmm. All right, I want to give Nick and Susie a chance here to ask some questions. So on behalf of youth workers, you know, what's burning for you?
Yeah, Julie, I mean, for me, it's like I'm with students all the time, and I know for a lot of other youth workers too, it's like, you know, we can talk about signs and everything, and I would love to hear maybe, you know, what are some signs that maybe we should be watching for in our students, both guys and girls, because I think it's going to look different for the different genders. But then, like, maybe if you could offer, like, some encouragement as well and, like, how not to overreact, because I think it'd be real easy if it's like, hey, this is one of the warning signs, and just to, like, jump in, like, oh, my gosh, do you have an eating disorder? You disordered eating, and, like, freak the kid out, and then maybe give them a complex thinking they do, which then could, you know, lead into that type of disorder.
Good question.
Yeah. So, the obvious one probably to all of us is when we see kids restricting their eating or skipping meals, not eating. The less obvious stuff is maybe appearance-oriented, a shift in dress, or how much you catch them looking at themselves or checking themselves out in mirrors. And it's when you know kids really well that you start to see those subtle cues. But they're not so subtle. I mean, think for a minute. You could be speaking with somebody who you know is not really tracking with you. They're nodding their head, but they're not really there and engaged with you. And that happens with young people who are kind of consumed with body image stuff. They're kind of not with you, not tracking with you. So you have the obvious things like watching a change in eating, skipping meals, talking about it. Sometimes it's encouraging other kids in the youth group not to eat, or targeting certain foods as bad is usually a sign to me as well when they start restricting. And it always does start out in a healthy way. Maybe I'm restricting sugar, but now all of a sudden there's no sugar. Now all of a sudden it's carbs. Now all of a sudden their world shrinks greatly. The less subtle things tend to be the materialism, the body image, the being self-consumed with appearance and looks. And you know what, probably you guys as youth workers see this even more. That's usually their friends telling on them and seeing it first and making those comments. And so you said something really important, and that's not overreacting and coming down hard on them. But even from a parental standpoint, one of the ways I try to handle that is just to emphasize healthy eating. I don't emphasize weight. I emphasize what does it look like to be healthy? And healthy means you have to eat enough in your meal, just as much as it means you can't eat too much of unhealthy stuff. So all things in moderation is something we say to our kids. Moderation, enjoy it. God created this. A food is a form of fellowship and community and communion with the Lord and each other. So let's use it in that way, but we're being a good stewards of our body, of our food, of all that we own. So it's a mentality that we're talking about. You're trying to develop a stewardship mentality about life and everything you own. And that's how I'd want to approach it with a young person as well. But obviously that takes time and effort too.
I love that, how you're talking about theology of food and stewardship of food. When was the last time we talked about that in youth group?
I tell my boys all the time, don't eat all the donuts.
Yeah, so. Well, that's okay. That's good. Yeah, but I mean, we don't address that enough. Okay, so what I really love the way you asked that question, Nick, about the overreaction, because I think that can happen. That was good. That was great to hear that. Let me ask this, though, to go back to the other side of that. Are there things, Julie, it's like with, you know, if you've got a kid who's thinking of taking their own life, sometimes we stand and we watch, we don't want to overreact, but there comes a point where you have to step in and ask the difficult questions, even if you're uncomfortable with it. What's that point for a youth worker with a student, like Nick's saying, where you suspect, you know, you're watching? Is there a threshold there where you're going, okay, you just need to flat out ask, are you struggling with this?
Yeah, and it could just be, hey, I've noticed you've not been eating a lot lately, or I noticed you skipped the meal. Everything okay? You feeling okay? So it can be that subtle that I'm just pointing out, hey, I'm noticing. Two, now I've seen a pattern, and I come back around and I say, so it's been a couple of times now. I've seen a pattern of you restricting or you skipping meals. Tell me what's going on. So again, I can ask as directly as, are you struggling with an eating disorder, or as non-directly as, I'm noticing. And tell me what you're thinking and feeling. Because what I'm doing then is I'm getting them to have to try to explain their behaviors, and I want to see what comes out, and then I'll engage with it.
Good.
So I do think when you notice, and notice out loud, but do it in a gracious way, do it in a way that's non-threatening, that invites conversation and invites them to open up.
Yeah, and in the context of relationship, we have the freedom to do that.
Yeah, I mean, because everything you're talking about, Julia, this is all relational based. It's like, I think for students, especially from a counseling perspective, it's when you can build that relationship and that trust, when you can come to them, they know you truly care. You're just not like, hey, by the way, I saw you pounded a dozen donuts in a sitting. Like, is something going on? It's like, hey, no, like, I care about you. Like, we're at camp, and I've noticed, like, at the past three meals, you haven't, like, eaten anything. You just drank water. Is everything, are you feeling okay? And I think when students see our heart behind it, that we truly do love them, that it's not their image that we're loving, we're seeing them as a child of God. I think in that moment, I think that's where the directness actually works to our advantage.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. One thing I say often is, I don't want to look at people as a problem to be fixed, but as a person to be cared for.
Yep. Image bearers. I like how you said that. You know, that's great language, you know, that we look at every human being as an image bearer that just gives them value, dignity, worth, and then causes us to treat them that way. Mm-hmm. Susie.
Yeah, so I have a couple questions. I think one, I'm going to piggyback a little bit on Nick's, is what age do we see some of the onsets of these disordered thinking about body image or eating? Because as a mom and a youth worker, I have an 8-year-old daughter. And so we recently had an issue where she came home from a play date and someone called her a boy. And so that really kind of set her on a little bit of, not a spiral, but she was like, do I look like a boy? Do I dress enough like a girl? And at 8, I'm thinking, darn it, I have to start thinking about this already.
Yeah.
So what age should we start looking for these things?
Well, it used to be that I would say around puberty and middle school that you start seeing some of those pressures. But again, I don't want to pick on social media, but I think that's a key element. Now, younger kids are being introduced to social media and they're being informed how to think about issues of sexuality and body image and all these things earlier and earlier. So one of the things I often say as a parent is I'd much rather be proactive than reactive. I'd rather proactively begin speaking in my children's lives about topics than wait until they've been given an inaccurate view and have to try to debunk it. So particularly with young people, it's just informing freedom to have imperfections, freedoms to be who you are, that God creates people differently with different strengths, weaknesses, and gifts and skills, and they're all okay. They're different. They're not less than, they're different than.
So good. I think a second question for youth workers is, so what do we do after we've talk to a student, identify that there might be an issue with eating or body image? What's our next steps?
I would think pretty closely after that is talking with the parents or the caretakers who are involved and bringing up your concern and expressing them. And as you guys know, sometimes it becomes very clear whether the parents are part of the problem or part of the solution. So bringing it forward to their parents is really important, and seeing how they respond to it. And sometimes after that, you know how much you're limited or how much freedom you have to speak into their world. So some parents then welcome, please mentor my child, talk to them, or thank you for bringing it to my attention. And then it opens the door for parents to start checking their social media accounts and finding out more things. So I think starting with the parents is key. And then even gently encouraging or nudging the student to get help, whether that's counseling or just talking to somebody regularly, would probably be a next step. And again, having resources that you can point families to, whether that's books, podcasts, or actual people they can meet with that might help them. So, you know, you're always trying to discern the level to which it's become problematic and when is intervention necessary and when have you caught it early.
Good. Good. Well, I love these questions, Julie. I want to honor your time. This has been great. But as we always do, I want to ask about resources. Is there anything else that would be helpful for the people who are listening to read, to watch, to listen to? I know we talked about Ed Welch's books. We talked about Jean Kilborn, Killing Us Softly. By the way, her video is online. You can find lectures that she's done, and she really does work through it pretty strong language and words. You know, she works through just what this stuff is doing, especially to young women. And I know she speaks on college campuses a lot, and you can see those lectures. You can find them on YouTube. We'll link to a couple of those. But anything else? And tell us how to get a hold of or to connect with CCEF as well.
Sure. So www.ccef.org. If you go online there, you can actually Google body image. And I'm not sure if I did a podcast on that at CCF. I think there was a blog on it. Dave Powelson's written some articles on it as well. So you can just Google body image on CCEF and you'll hear similar things to what we're talking about today on the topic. I love your recommendation of FaceTime. I've seen the book. I haven't read it yet. So now you have just convinced me to buy it and have that in my library. So I'd affirm that. And Ed Welch's book for teenagers, What Do You Think About Me and Why Do I Care, is an excellent resource to walk through, whether it's a mentoring or parent-child relationship. I think so much of it is key in relationship and living in community and talking about these things openly and proactively.
Good. I'm going to mention, too, from CCEF, because we take these with us when we speak places, the little booklets that you folks have that you put out on the different topics related to spiritual health, mental health, that sort of thing. There are some great books in there, booklets in there, that a youth worker or a church can put out in a foyer or you can give to parents. They're readable, they're short, and there's a lot on body image, appearance, disordered eating, that sort of thing in there. So you can find those on the CCEF website as well. So, Julie, thank you. Thanks so much for being a part of this. I'm glad that we got the technology to work and that we're able to have you in. We're going to have you in again, I know. And so thanks for joining us. And Nick and Susie, this is a joy to have you guys in here to ask these questions, because you're right there with kids, you're right there with families, and it's good to be able to hear you ask questions on behalf of the youth workers who listen. So, well, thank you, everybody. Again, check out the podcast page to find links to all these resources. And we're grateful for those who have joined us today. And we look forward to talking to you again on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.